one. I'm delighted, absolutely delighted to be talking to Catherine Bevel-Singh today, and Britain's most celebrated, most famous and most influential head of any school, and indeed one of the world's most influential and best known heads. Catherine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Let us begin, can we, with your own life. How did you get from New Zealand all the way here? And what was your own experience of schooling like?
Yes, my father was a great traveller. So he went, took my mum to New Zealand, and I came along at that time for a year. They lived there. They then returned to Canada, where I spent most of my childhood until the age of 15, when we moved to Leamington Spa. Well, those are the pips at school. So,
and your father was an academic. Just tell us about the influence of your father and your mother on your own views about society and about education.
Well, my parents are West Indian. So I was brought up in a, I say, small C conservative household, Caribbean household, which was fairly typical in the 1970s and 80s. And then we went to Leamington, and I went to a school there for a couple of years and did my A-levels, and then ended up at Oxford. And then I was going to just finish at Oxford, but then I stayed, and I've sort of just never left, and I've always been here. And my parents have, still live in Canada. But originally met in Jamaica when my father went from Guyana to Jamaica to go to the University of the West Indies, where he met my mum. My mum was a nurse and my father was a professor in a university in Toronto.
And your father's academic specialism?
English.
And political views. And Catherine, your left-wing, revolutionary left-wing views. I don't know how revolutionary they were, actually, but... when you were at Oxford?
Yes, so I was brought up in a left-wing household, although small-C conservative. In those days, you could very much be left-wing and small-C conservative. There's a few of them left, although fewer these days. And my father was very much, he still is very politically on the left, as is my mum. I think, you know, they were slightly surprised when their daughter stopped being as left-leaning as I once was. Yes, my father was a post-colonial professor. So, you know, he was a real expert at Caribbean literature. People like Derek Walcott or V.S. Naipaul were favourites of his.
And yours? Who's your favourite novelist?
I tend to read lots of non-fiction. So lots of non-fiction about the sorts of things that interest me, children, schools, also... lots on race and society and how people work, really. How do societies function and how do we make society the best it can possibly be?
And it's very well known that you were hugely influenced by E.D. Hirsch's book, The Schools We Need and Why We Don't Have Them, which was published first in 1999. Can you tell us about the influence of E.D. Hirsch on you? And what was he saying, Catherine, that really got to you?
Well, you know, I didn't know E.D. Hirsch when I was teaching normally and before I gave that speech of mine in 2010 at the Conservative Party conference. It was at that conference that I met Nick Gibb. And he then later suggested that I read E.D. Hirsch because he heard me, you know, he would listen to me. And the things I said seemed to chime very much with what E.D. Hirsch was saying. And he said, oh, you'll like this book. So, and he was right. I did like it. And what were the things that I was saying to Nick Gibb at the time? Was that, a more old-fashioned, traditional classroom needed to be, was needed to help poor kids. You need learning to be led by the teacher from the front of the classroom. We need to tell children things instead of allowing them to just guess what's in your head and wasting lots of time. We need to teach them, is what I'd say. And I think a lot less of that had been happening in British education. These days, more of it is happening, but it's still the case. I get lots of teachers who come to visit the school here. We get 1,000 guests every year. And number one thing, I said it today at lunch when I met with the guests, I said, it's not cheating, it's teaching. You've got to tell them what you know, because without knowledge, one cannot be creative. You cannot think for yourself about something if you don't know much about it. So it is extremely important for us to prize knowledge and to have it as central when teaching in terms of our ambitions and our motivations and, you know, what are we doing in the classroom? We want to give them knowledge.
Is it the teaching, Catherine, from another human being that matters, or is it the knowledge itself? And what do you think about us young people acquiring knowledge but without the medium of a teacher? Is it still knowledge? Is it still as valuable?
Is it still as valuable? No, it isn't. I think relationships between people, whether that's parental, whether it's the teacher, the privilege that we adults have to lead children, to be in a position of authority but not become authoritarian, to love them enough to keep our standards high for them, to teach them something and to watch them grow. Well, it's just the most wonderful thing. I mean, now, look, of course they can go and read a book somewhere and find stuff out. But to really get excited about something, I think you need interaction with someone else over it. And a teacher who you love and trust, who inspires you, well, there's nothing like it. That's why teaching is the best job in the world.
Well, I agree with you, Catherine, but some people would say that AI is much better at giving young people personalised learning, and you can have the face and you can have the voice of the teacher, and however good it might be in 2026, by 2031, in 5 years' time, it will be infinitely better. Is there something sacred about the human teacher, and what is it that the AI will never replicate?
Well, it's that relationship and that inspiration. But you can obviously have an AI teacher at home helping you out and giving you some knowledge that you need to fill in the gaps. But to be motivated, to be inspired, to have that interaction, that human interaction. I mean, I would have thought it's just obvious. You know, if you're just looking at your phone all day, it sort of kills the soul.
Well, it's obvious to us, but it's not obvious to a lot of other people around the world who are saying, including in the Department for Education this week, that AI can replicate many of the functions of the teacher. You're not one of those who agreed.
No, although I do recognise that some schools really struggle to get teachers. And in those circumstances, it's absolutely better, obviously, to have AI replace a non-existent teacher. But if you can get an excellent teacher, then, no one can compete with that. It's like gold dust. But the problem is it is like gold dust. So some school leaders will want to use AI to replace some perhaps poor teaching or non-existent teaching.
So after French and philosophy at Oxford, you were motivated to go and teach. Why did you not want to go off and earn a lot of money in France as a philosopher? Or doing something else?
Well, I had spent time participating with a group of other ethnic minorities who were going into various inner city schools in Birmingham, Manchester and London, talking to children in those inner city schools to say, look, in those days, there weren't many black kids who went to Oxford. And the idea was, look, if I can survive and I'm doing well, then you can apply and maybe you'll get in and you'll be fine. And it really was the first time they'd ever considered the idea of Oxbridge. And I'd speak to them and I'd see that I changed their minds. And I was thinking, oh, wow, well, you know, this is really bringing me some meaning in my life. That's the point about a teacher. It brings you meaning. An AI bot cannot do that.
Absolutely. And should Oxford and Cambridge positively discriminate in favour of young people from disadvantaged backgrounds compared to, say, schools like Wellington?
No. We don't positively discriminate because, one, it lowers the standards for the children who you're discriminating for. You know, though so in the end, you get a place, but you don't really deserve the place. It makes a mockery of the standard because there is no standard. The idea of making it to Oxford one then no longer is meaningful because they change the requirements depending on who's getting in. It must be very embarrassing for somebody if they're there and they're not really meant to be there and they must struggle to keep up. So I think that that's why primary and secondary education are so important, because the problem that Oxford and Cambridge have is that if a child has not been taught properly, by the time they're 17, it's almost impossible to try and catch it up. And I know they are trying. They've got that year's foundation year that people can do to try and get them to catch up. But it is too late. What we need is excellent schools, and for that to be happening at least by the age of 11, so those children can catch up properly and be in a stronger position later to apply to the top universities.
You started writing a very early blogger, an anonymous blog to Miss With Love as Miss Snuffy. What was all that about?
Well, I had begun writing a sort of diary, you know, a paper diary with my stories, because it was quite cathartic. I'd go home and talk about how little Johnny had had his money stolen and how outraged I was, and I'd just write a story. And then someone said to me, you should write a blog. I said, oh, what's that? And then he showed me in one of those easy internet cafes, just to date that for you. And we sat.
Yeah, this is 2007, by the way.
Yes. So we created this this blog. I called myself Miss Snuffy after Mr. Snuffleupagus off Sesame Street, who was the big elephant in the room, and no one could see him. And then eventually on the blog, I ended up being called Miss Snuffy, not just Miss Snuffleupagus. And I used to come 3 times a week, perhaps. I'd come home and I'd write a story. And it was really lovely because, it just gave me an opportunity to vent a bit about the things that I was seeing, the things I was outraged by, because I felt we were letting children down. And when I say we, I just mean the establishment, you know, education, schools, etc.
And then your sensational projection onto the national stage at the Cassette Party Conference in October 2010, which you referred to earlier. I mean, that was such a moment. How did you feel when you do? Tell us about that whole experience.
Yes, well, I remember sitting in the green room. That's where I met Nick Gibb. And I was talking about what I thought. And I remember him turning around to his people and saying, why have I never met this before? And because I think he liked what I was saying. And then, I went on. The thing is, you need to know that that morning, there have been dozens of people talking to that audience. I was just one of many. The reason why we all remember my speech is because I suppose I spoke well, the audience liked what I was saying, and they gave me a standing ovation. And because of that, it was at that moment that the press turned to me and said, who is she? And my whole life changed in that moment.
We remember the Conservative Party Conference really in the last 40 years for two speeches, yours and the young William Hague, aged about 12, in his Yorkshire accent. And tell us how your world changed at that point, because you're about to change here the world of education. But how did your world change?
Yes, well, in the end, I ended up without a job, basically. I mean, there was so much press. There was so much fury around that. I mean, as you can imagine, you know, I got sent home because there was so much attention from school. I'd also only been at the school for a few weeks because I'd started in September and the conference was in beginning of October. So, and it was a new school for me. And I just, in the end, I had to resign. And I was told I'd never work in the state education system again. And so you can imagine the right-wing press went mad saying, look, teacher stands up and tells the truth. And she basically is kicked out of state education. This is outrageous. And so in the end, I had to start finding my way back into teaching, which meant setting up a free school. That was the only way I'd be able to teach disadvantaged children. I mean, I could have gone into the private sector, but it wasn't. I mean, I have no problem with private schools, but it's not my thing. My thing has always been disadvantaged kids in the inner city. So the only way I could do that would be to set up a school. It took us 3.5 years in the end. I didn't expect it would take 3.5 years. I thought it would take us a year like everyone else. But there were so many detractors trying to stop us from opening. They didn't like the idea of a traditional education. They didn't like the idea of me, who had spoken at the Conservative Party conference, setting up a school. And so there were protests. They would interrupt our parents' evenings, sitting amongst the mums from Brixton Market, and start shouting when we would speak in order to drown us out. They would picket us. They had placards with Tory teacher written on it. They would shout abuse at me. We had to hire bouncers at one event because we were so worried about the possible violence that would ensue. At one event, this woman stood up and said, you betrayed us when you spoke at the Conservative Party conference. And I just thought, I don't even know who you are. How could I betray you? This is crazy. So it took us a long time to open, but we did open in 2014.
You came to Wellington at that time and you spoke persuasively about setting it up and the problems that you faced, and we tried to give you support that we could. Who is the they, though, who were against you, and who were they speaking for, Catherine?
Well, a lot of people in the unions. There was an Anti-Academies Alliance group that were against us. There were some just ordinary teachers. They were bussed in from outside of London. So they've come to the events that were for the local people to find out about this extra possibility of a school, and these people who had been bussed in from outside. And I have to say, it was really stark, the difference, because all the mums there would be black and brown, and all the people who had been bussed in from outside were all white middle class, who came along to disrupt the opportunity for these brown and black mums to have another choice of school. I mean, it's completely outrageous.
What were they afraid of? What were they afraid of?
Well, the unions felt they were losing power with the whole free school movement. And we were a particular target because I was a bigger name, you know. So other free schools might have gone along a bit more quietly. Although, having said that, there were other schools, two other schools that tried to open up in Brent. They never did. I mean, so I'm only here to tell the tale, right? There are others can't tell the tale because they just never opened, because their detractors got the better of them.
How hard was it for you to keep going?
Okay.
Did you ever think, this is just too much nastiness?
Yeah, I never thought it was too much, but I got ill, I got eczema all over me. I mean, it was very, very hard. I mean, I've had to, you know, you have to dig deep and keep going. You know, when I stand up at assembly and tell the kids that they need to do that, I know that I've done it myself many times.
And Nick Gibb, you mentioned twice already, and how significant were he and Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, and Dominic Cummings was there as special advisor. What about them?
I've never met Dominic Cummings. I've never spoken to him. But Nick Gibb and Michael Gove have been extremely supportive. And, I mean...
Could you have done it without them?
Yes. Yes, although I say yes. They are the ones that created the political climate and the old notion of free schools to allow us to have a school. But we were just like any other school, going through the motions through the Department for Education. They didn't have anything to do with that. So, yes, once they'd sort of set it up for everyone, then, yes, we were just like any other school. I think people sometimes had this idea that somehow we're sort of special. I mean, not at all. We're just like any other school. Frankly, it's far more difficult for us because we're constantly in the limelight. So people are constantly taking shots at us. But and have tried to stop us, whereas other free schools, as I was saying, might have had less opposition. But no, like there were no favors done. I mean, they can't do favors. I mean, you have to go through the systems.
So what's happening here? I mean, you have what would be described as a left-wing idea for saying that working-class children have every right to a top quality education, and that their background's not going to hold them back, and that they can reach for the sky. And then you have left-wing unions stopping you, but you're being supported by right-wing politicians. I didn't understand any of that.
Well, because I wouldn't say that what we're doing is a left-wing idea. I'd say it is very much on the right. So what are we doing? We're giving...
Really?
Yes, we're giving children equal opportunity. We're not imposing equality after the fact. So someone who leans to the right believes in equal opportunity where from 11 or from before, what was I saying? You need to give them quality education so that they have equal opportunity. Someone who thinks more on the left thinks it doesn't really matter what happens at the start, as long as at the end you have a quota for Oxford or Cambridge, for instance, and then you place those people there despite perhaps them not meeting the standards. Then, so you impose equality at the end, or you believe in equality of opportunity. Equality of opportunity is very much a right-wing idea.
Is there any limit to what a child can achieve?
Of course. I mean, I believe in nature and nurture. Robert Plowman's book, Blueprint, I once got into a big argument with him. He was at one of those Intelligence Square debates, and he sat up at the front saying, it doesn't matter what school you send your child to, it doesn't matter if you read to your child in the evenings, won't make any difference because genes are everything. And then I said to him, wait a minute, your own book doesn't say that. Your own book says it's about half and half. And to be honest, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you how much is nurture, how much is nature. But obviously, it's a bit of both. Except we can't do anything about the nature. We can do something about the nurture, and we need to make sure that children are immersed in a culture that's going to push them and support them and love them and really challenge them. And now, again, we can't do anything about the families. Sometimes the families, they come from families where they're not necessarily going to get that at home. But as soon as they come to school, we need to make sure that we're using every minute to increase the excitement and the interest and the knowledge that they can gain in those few hours that they've got at school. You know, the thing is that when a child goes back to a more middle-class home, they'll have books there. Their parents take them on holidays to a wide variety of places around the world. They go to the theater and art galleries and so on. A child from a more deprived background does not, which means they are depending entirely on their school to give them what they need to have that equality of opportunity to make something of themselves.
So you opened in 2014 and you're now in your 13th year, and it is 12th year. You are achieving extraordinary results. Why are there not more Michaelas? Are there plans for more Michaelas? Are there more Michaelas?
No. I mean, I wish there were. We tried to open a primary school. The Department for Education stopped that. We tried to set up a leadership program for deputies and head teachers to come and learn from what we do. The Department for Education stopped that. We tried to open a secondary school. Now, that wasn't the Department for Education. That was more COVID that got in the way. And then it scuppered all the plans for us to be able to open the secondary that we had planned. So in the end, I realized I cannot expect the state. And this was under the Conservatives. The Conservatives, you know, so this idea that the Conservatives are helping us is just nonsense. You know, we were blocked at everything we tried to do. We've managed to get lucky with this school. I've just decided, you know what? We do a great job here. Let's open it up to everyone. We get 1,000 guests every year who come to see us from around the country. Today, we had a delegation of Estonians. Yesterday, we have the Canadian education minister on Friday. We had the Australian shadow education minister last Friday. We've got teachers from all over the world, some from Northern Ireland today, some from South London. And they come here and we've got, you know, 15, 20 guests a day. And it's really lovely. I speak to them every day and they ask advice about how, what to do with their schools and how to make their schools better. And that's how we're doing it underground. The influence is being spread in a human way, not through an AI way, in a human way.
Okay. So I completely get that you were helped very much by Nikib and by Michael Gove at the beginning, but the Department for Education doesn't exist. It's people. Who was blocking you and why were they blocking you? Conservatives. If as you say, they should be believing in equality of opportunity.
Civil servants. It's not the ministers. The ministers are fighting with the civil servants. And the civil servants are...
Which civil servants?
Well, I can't say which ones, I don't know. But the civil servants are definitely... I always say it's the civil servants around the country, not the politicians. We are mistaken to think it's the Prime Minister who's in charge.
Okay, so you therefore subscribe to the blob theory, that there is a deep state?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I've dealt with it all my life. That's why there are no more Michaelas.
Let's talk about your plans for evolving. How has your thinking, Catherine, developed? I mean, I remember talking to you at length before you began, and you were just full of this extraordinary, extraordinarily inspiring, clear idea about what the school should be. How has it changed in its years of existence?
Well, I mean, it's got better, but I wouldn't say it's changed enormously. You know, we're tweaking constantly and getting better at what we do and discovering new ideas and thinking, oh, that's a nice idea from a school, let's put that in. But generally speaking, the three things that we started with that make us different have remained, which is that we have traditional discipline, we have traditional teaching, and we have traditional values. And those three things are still there and are very much at the heart of the school.
Teaching, culture, values, learning. What's a traditional teacher do that other teachers don't? And how difficult has it been to recruit people who are buying into your way?
Yeah. Well, nobody buys into our way until I persuade them. So if they apply for a job here, they're obviously open-minded and wanting to think, oh, well, I want to learn what they do. But nobody's a Michaela teacher until we teach them how to become a Michaela teacher. And so we tend to have lots of young teachers who are wanting to learn our methods and are really, you know, excited about doing things differently. Traditional teacher stands at the front of the classroom. The desks would be in rows as opposed to facing each other. And the teacher then leads the learning and is very much the authority in the room without being authoritarian. You know, we get those two mixed up. They love the kids, but they hold their standards high. So that's what a traditional teacher looks like. Traditional discipline is just, you know, giving them detentions, praise and punishment, merits and demerits, that sort of thing, and being consistent about it.
And the corridors?
And our corridors, yes. So they're not chatting to each other, but they will say good morning and good afternoon to their teachers. And it means that we get maximum amount of time with the children in their lessons. When you have a child who's 11 years old, but he actually has a reading age of a 7-year-old, you want as much time as possible in the lessons to expose him to the teacher and to the learning that he requires to catch up and have that equal opportunity with his peers at, say, private schools. And if there are fights going on in the corridors, if there's tons of children, bashing each other and throwing each other up against the walls, and some teachers might listen to me saying, well, that's ridiculous, that doesn't happen. Well, then they've never worked in the inner city, is all I can say, because that is certainly what happened my entire career.
And talk about no excuses, that philosophy.
Yes, yeah, so it's insisting that children can do better. If you haven't got your homework, well, then that's on you. And you're not going to come in with, oh, my dog ate my homework, my sister took my homework, etc. You're just going to take it on the chin. You're going to take that detention. And then you know what happens? The children all come in with their homework. That's what happens. You know, if you just hold the line on these things, it means you get all the kids doing the homework. And if they don't, well, they sit at detention, but there's a small number of them, and the next day they do it. It's really quite simple and quite old-fashioned, but I find it works.
A good teacher, what are you looking for, Catherine?
Well, it could be a teacher, it could be a caretaker, it could be a member of the kitchen staff. I'm always looking for the same things. First thing is intelligence. I want people who are bright. Second thing is enthusiastic. So for teachers, that means, do you love kids? Do you love being in the classroom? Do you like your job? Because if you don't like your job as a teacher, then that really is a disaster. And then the third thing is how conscientious they are. Are they conscientious? They're going to put some hours in order to give what you can to the kids and, you know, really love them.
You mentioned love several times, and that's not a word that many people use in schools, and indeed some would disapprove of its use. To you, very explicitly, love for a child means what exactly? Spell it out, please.
Well, they're just great, aren't they? They're so cute. They point out things you've never noticed before. They're just... I love watching them grow and seeing how they develop over the years. And actually, I feel the same way about my staff. So I love my staff. I love them and I love working with them. It's one of the reasons
why. Do you tell them that?
Yes, all the time. I love working with them because, they keep me on my toes. So it's just like the kids. They keep me on my toes. They make me see things in different ways. They push back when they think I'm wrong. They're challenging and interesting, but it's also my role to lead and to help develop them and into better versions of themselves. And it's the same. It's my teacher's role to be with the children and to help the children develop into better versions of themselves. And I am helping the teachers develop into better versions of themselves. And there's nothing that I'm more proud of than seeing, you know, when my teachers stay here for some years and then they leave and they give me a card saying how they were such different people when they started at Michaela and how they've learned so much and they've changed and they've become different people and so on, and that their values are different. And the way in which, you know, often teachers will start here young and they get married and then they have children and they say to me that they will raise their children differently to how they would have done if they'd never taught at Michaela. It's just an amazing thing to be able to have impact on teachers and also on children. And on society, that is what brings meaning to one's life.
Incredibly special. And would Britain be better if there was a Michaela School in every town and city and village? Should every school be a Michaela School? And could we have Michaela Schools without you, Catherine, as the head?
Well, I hope so. And certainly a version of Michaela. And yes, I do think there should be one in every town. More than one, perhaps a few, because there aren't any. I don't think every school should be like Michaela because I recognize that not all families would want it. So I do like families having some choice. But the country would be so much better if we had Michaela schools everywhere because actually I think you'd find then that the other schools would do a lot more copying of what goes on at Michaela.
And what are the best and the most copyable aspects You probably mentioned them already, but just to spell it out.
Well, it's the traditional stuff. It's understanding that we adults are in charge, that we are the authority, and not pandering to children. Not just, you've given me an excuse, I'll accept that and just allow you to hit the lowest standards possible, to hold our standards high for them, and to understand that that is what is to love them. That instead, you see, people think that compassion is letting children off their detention. It's quite the opposite. You're doing that for yourself. You're doing that because you're indulging your own sense of awkwardness over the idea of giving the child a detention. What you should do is be brave enough to hold the line with the child and teach him a lesson so that he learns from that. Because you're always moving towards the goal of where you want the child to be tomorrow, next week, next year, and so on. And that's what's so exciting about being a teacher. It's being able to influence them in that way. If all you're doing is you're just stamping the tests that you mark, you might as well just be some administrator. You know, if all you're doing is allowing children off when you really should hold them to account and do what's difficult. And we say, even when it's difficult, especially when it's difficult, you do the right thing. Well, that's what we teachers need to do. Teaching is the hardest profession that exists, I believe. And it's the most exciting one and the best one. And there is one best way of doing it. That's the other thing. We believe in one best way of teaching, and we're all aiming to get there.
And your energy and enthusiasm, what do you really do to keep it up?
Well, I did my inclined walking at 5 a.m. this morning, you'll be pleased to know.
Your what walking? Incline.
Inclined walking, yes.
At 5 a.m., normal time for getting up? Let's get personal.
Yes. Well, I do my inclined walking. Some influencer made it popular. And, you know, my teachers, they're all young. They run marathons. I've got one teacher who ran 107 miles between London and Oxford on some crazy marathon. I mean, I'm not running 107 miles, but I am doing my inclined walking. I'm looking after my knees. And, you know, it keeps me young, I hope.
And does it mean you go to bed at 9 or 10 early every night?
Yes, that's right. I try and
get Is that better to do that and wake up early?
Well, yes, it's an interesting thing. I've tried that. But, you know, tonight you've caught me just at the point where I'm thinking I might get a better night's sleep if I was to do the exercise in the evening. So today, Anthony, you are going to hold me to account. Tomorrow, you're going to send me a text because I did my incline walking this morning. I am going to do it again this evening before I go to sleep to see whether or not I get a better night's sleep. And you can hold me to account tomorrow.
Well, I will. And the next day, try the incline walking backwards. I mean, walking backwards is extraordinary. Seriously, I've started walking backwards. It's a lot to be said for it, but not on this podcast. Where is this finally the future? Where does it go for you? If Kemi Badenoch won and invited you to be a sec, or if Nigel Farage won and asked you to be the education secretary, would you say yes?
Never.
Honestly.
In a million years. Never in a million years.
You could influence the entire schooling for every child in the country massively.
Ah, but Anthony, I hope I'm already doing that.
You are, in your subtle way. And you wouldn't want to lose it.
Yeah, the thing is that I think we all underestimate just how much power ordinary people have. Ordinary people in ordinary places make a massive difference. And we all must remember that and do what is brave.
And the proudest thing of your life?
Oh, I don't know. Gosh. You know, I think about all the children. I think about all the staff. I couldn't name any single one of them. But when I look at them all and what they've become and what we've managed to achieve here, I'm very proud of that.
Understandably. Catherine Bebel-Singh, thank you very much indeed. That was wonderful.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.